From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most of us get the fact that honeybees are industrious, so we usually think well of them. But there aren't many of us who want to be part of a hive. We resist the idea of groupthink. Thomas Seeley says it's true there are plenty of examples where groups make lousy decisions. Just look at stock market bubbles. But he says honeybees can teach us a lot about making the right decision, because when they get together to decide on a new home, for example, bees almost always get it right. Seeley studies bees, and he's discovered that even though there are individual creatures who have limited intelligence or limited information, together they've developed a kind of collective wisdom. Today in the program, Thomas Seeley is joining us to talk about what humans can learn from what he calls honeybee democracy. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thomas Seeley knows a remarkable amount about honeybees. Some of it we're going to talk about today. But there's one part of the behavior of these creatures that is still a mystery to Seeley. He knows that in late spring, a large group of honeybees will decide to leave the security of the hive to start a new one. They go and form a swarm on a tree branch. And what he doesn't understand is just how they all decide at the same time that they're going to go and do this, go and swarm. He does know it's a collective decision. Seeley says honeybees have a lot to teach us about the process of making decisions because they've evolved this complex way of acting together. Today in the program, Thomas Seeley is joining us to talk about all of this because he says it's a process of debate. It's a system for resolving conflicts. But once they've received a kind of consensus, it's not long before they're off. Thomas Seeley is a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University. He's in Utah for the Utah Symposium in Science and Literature. And welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
I want to start with, we were chatting just briefly for a moment off air about our own kind of affections. I have a weird affection for honeybees I don't understand, and ants I'm not sure I understand. Obviously, you do too. Did this start really young for you?
It did start young. It started for me in third grade when our teacher had a beekeeper come into the room and bring combs of honey, showed us the inside of a hive. And I remember distinctly smelling those, the fresh honey and the wax, and learning that insects live together so harmoniously. It was like stepping into a very special world. And so I was hooked from an early age.
You've spent most of your life in Ithaca, New York. You write about spending time there, you know, in the rural parts, exploring the forests and the fields. There's a point at which you came across some wooden hives at an old farmhouse.
That's right. That's right. And that was really the next step for me. Seeing these, I would bike up to those hives. And I didn't know anything about beekeeping at that point, so I couldn't open the hives, and they weren't my hives. But I could sit in front of the hives and watch the bees coming and going. And yes, the tremendous industry of those bees and just the beauty of the bees coming and going, flying off, soaring and up against the sky, it nurtured my fascination.
I really like this. You described lying in the grass in front of the hives. If you do that, it's like a meteor shower.
That's right. That's right. You watch these bees heading out, arcing off against the sky, and they're going every which direction. It's a wonderful sight. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. So, what is the is there a gift you have to have to be, you know, not just a scientist who studies honeybees, but someone who keeps honeybees? I mean, you know, you often hear, my wife says that bees sense if you're afraid, you know, that people who are, you know, freaking out too much will get stung. Do you know, I mean, is there a sense of calmness or something about people who relate to bees? Does that make sense?
I think there really is, Doug. to be a good beekeeper, you have to be somebody that is comfortable working slowly and gently and smoothly so you don't bang the bees, jar them, because that would be, if you did that, you'd be simulating what a predator like a bear does when it, when it's attacking the nest. So you have to be comfortable being light in your touch.
I wonder, there's one thing that you've talked about, putting your hand inside a swarm. Now, I get you've also explained that, well, the bees that are swarming at this point, they're not defending anything yet. So they won't sting, right? But still, that takes a lot of guts to stick your hand inside of a swarm, doesn't it? You know what I like the most about that story is you talk about how warm it is. It must kind of have a comforting feeling in
some
way.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, Doug, because I know a lot of people have seen a swarm of bees. It's this mass of bees about the size of a soccer ball, and it can hang from a tree branch or a stop sign or a mailbox, whatever. And the first time you see one, well, it looks absolutely terrifying. It's 10,000 stinging insects hanging there. And often it's not clear, are they building a nest or what's going on? Is this a problem I'm going to have if it's in my backyard? I really want to stress the fact that, as you pointed out, these bees are not defensive. They're not stinging. Plus, it's a they're just there temporarily. They're bivouacked there, and they're looking for a home, and they will be moving on in a day or two. And yes, the reason you do the bit about putting a finger or a hand into the cluster of this worm is simply to demonstrate the peacefulness of those bees.
You found a swarm on a summer day in 1969. You've written about this, hanging from a tree branch. And you collected them. I mean, I guess this was your first your first hive, is that right?
Those were my first bees. I was doing a summer job. Summer job involved hives of bees in the middle of fields for to pollinate. And one day one of those hives swarmed, and I knew enough that a swarm of bees could be put into a box. I quickly made a wooden box that evening after work, got them in the box, brought them home, and then I could had bees that I could study myself.
In that time, as I understand it, you've written about the fact that you weren't thinking of devoting your life to studying animal behavior or insect behavior, or bees for that matter. I mean, you were planning on being a physician. What was the sort of clincher? What was the moment when you figured maybe this could be my life's work?
Well, this may sound a little bit odd, Doug, but I was talking about that decision, which path to go, because they're really both biology.
Yeah.
I was talking about it with my mother, and my mother said, Tom, I think you'd be better working with healthy bees than with sick humans. So that for me was an important moment.
Yeah. There's an acclaimed honeybee researcher, Martin Lindauer. Lindauer.
Yes. Yep.
Martin Lindauer. And he had written this paper that you discovered. I like this story. You found it. It was this 60-plus page paper about honeybee behavior. But it was in German.
Right.
You took this paper, you translated, you sort of broke it down. What is it about that paper you wanted to get at? This was in the beginnings of you trying to figure out how the behavior of hives worked?
Yes. What the first step was reading a small book that Martin Lindauer had written in English, was translated in English. It was based on a series of lectures he gave at Harvard. And it was written for a very general audience, very accessible. And he told this amazing story that honeybees have this process whereby they work together, communicate, share information to choose a new home. But it was only his description there was very very simple. He had very greatly simplified things. If you wanted to get the real goods on this story, you had to go look at the original scientific publication, and that's the one that you mentioned. It's this whopper, 60 pages in German, dense, probably 30 graphs in it. And yes, I knew that was a treasure box, and I wanted to open it up, so I had to learn German.
You write about how when you translated that, you realized the more you learned, the more you realized that there were as many questions as there were answers to all of this. And in fact, you describe as one of the motives for your book as being that what you wanted to do is you wanted to sort of get all this research together? Because you've mentioned it's sort of scattered all over the place. You wanted to get it all together and present it to people, I guess.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's always, almost always the situation in science. We report the science as particular studies in a short paper, typically in a scientific journal. And it means the whole story is chopped up into slices and they're scattered. And so in science, at least in biology, books still play an important role of integrating that, synthesizing it, putting it and giving the reader the big picture.
What do we know about bees? I mean, relatively speaking, do you feel like?
How so? I mean, that's a huge question.
Well, what I mean is, let's say, do you feel like you don't feel smug about the fact that we've figured them out. I mean, you know a lot about, and we're going to talk about some very particular behavior, but where are we relatively speaking in terms of our knowledge about bees, do you figure?
Oh, I can't put a number on it, Doug, but I would say we're still scratching the surface.
Really?
Yes. If you go inside a beehive, and I think any beekeeper would agree with me on this, if you said, well, do we really understand how a colony of bees organizes itself and makes decisions like when they're going to build their comb, how much brood they're going to rear, when a queen bee is too old and needs to be replaced, when a colony is going to decide, how they control their heat production or their water collection or their nectar collection. We know something about all of those things, but do we have a thorough knowledge of them for any of those? Probably not. And if anything, the house hunting story is the one where we have the greatest depth of understanding.
And that's the one I want to break down today. I wonder, though, are bees unique in the animal world in the way they make collective decisions, or do we see this all the time?
Well, they're pretty special,
but
they're not unique. There is a ants have a very ants all of the social many social insects face the same situation of a colony needing to find a new nesting site. This might be because a new colony has been budded off from an established colony and the new unit has to find a new home. That's the situation for the honeybees. But sometimes the old nest deteriorates or is damaged or is broken up by a predator. And that's what happens in some ant species. And that's been studied very, very nicely by a group in England. The process in these ants, remarkably, is very similar to what goes on in the bees. So, no, the bees aren't unique, but they are special.
We have to start with this kind of basic principle, which is kind of at the heart of the book, and that is that a honeybee colony may have a queen in it, but it's not a monarchy. It's not a dictatorship. It's a family.
That's right. So that's a very important point that when a colony of bees, a swarm of bees, chooses a new home, that swarm does contain a queen, but the queen is really misnamed. The queen implies a royal decider. She's really a royal egg layer. She's not involved in this decision. She's just accompanying the worker bees. She is, of course, essential. She's the heart of the colony. She's the mother of all of the bees in the colony. So she's very special in terms of her genetics. She is the genetic heart of the colony, but she's not a key information processing unit.
You say there's one really important way in which the queen, though, does sort of exercise some level of, I'm not sure if leadership is the way to put it, but she secretes this substance called the queen substance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so, for example, that queen substance is used by the workers to detect if the queen is present or absent in the colony. If one should die, for example, that will quickly signal to them. The absence of that signal tells them that they need to rear a replacement from some of the young larvae in the colony. And when a colony swarms, the bees rush out. Two-thirds of the colony rushes out of the existing hive with the mother queen, and then they have to assemble themselves into this swarm of bees from a tree branch, and they have to make that assemblage around the queen bee. So they're paying close attention to where she is sitting. They detect her location by the smell of this queen substance pheromone.
It's a smell, or is it sticky? What is it?
It's what chemists call a fatty acid. It's kind of a it's it's a greasy compound, but it does have what's called enough vapor pressure so that enough molecules come off that into the air that the workers can smell it. So they do respond to her by smelling that material.
So in some ways too, this substance is her saying, "I'm doing great. I'm fine. I'm alive, and
I'm alive, and I'm here,
and I'm here." Yeah, that's what she's conveying to the family. I want to get to this idea of collective intelligence before we break down how they find a home, because I want to work through that, as I said. But give us a sense of this. There's the kind of collective intelligence, you say, it's not unlike the way a multitude of cells in the body work.
Yeah, in particular, it's remarkably the organization of the way that the bees in a swarm are organized is remarkably similar to the way the neurons in invertebrate brains are organized to take in information and make decisions. We can go into the details of that, but knowing that gives us a pretty strong indication that the organization that the bees have settled on and the way the neurons in the brain have settled on, the fact that they're so similar suggests strongly that this really is a good way, a very good way to do it. And in fact, the models we have of this, the abstract models we have of these, both of these processes, which are is the same model, indicates that it gives you an optimal decision-making system. It gives you the most accuracy for a given amount of time to make the decision, or it minimizes the time to achieve a given level of accuracy. To me, that's probably the deepest message of all in this whole story.
You've described the process by which honeybees choose their new home as a democratic decision-making process. Let's set up the scenario, because I want you to sort of take us through this. It's late spring, early summer. We're not sure when they make the decision, but at some point they decide we're too big, right? And we've got to go off. Some of us do. I guess we don't know which of us do, right? We don't know how they decide. You stay here, I'm going to go make the new colony.
That's right. That's one of those mysteries. We don't know how. What we do know is that when a colony is strong at the right time of year, last spring or early summer, two-thirds or three-quarters of a strong colony will leave with the mother queen they leave to establish a new colony. Meanwhile, back in the original nest, new queens are being reared, one of which will take over the existing nest and perpetuate that colony. So one colony buds or fissions into two.
Yeah. Is that a struggle between the new queens?
There is a fight to the death among the queens that are reared in the parental hive over who will inherit those resources, those tremendous resources.
So they leave, they settle on a tree branch, as you say, and they hang there for several hours, or sometimes several days, I guess it is. And this is the really critical time here, because what they're deciding... your book is about this process, this process, this particular several hundred of the – it's the veterans. It's the old guys, the guys who – the ladies who know where the bodies are buried. They know how it works, right? I mean that seems important. They're the experienced ones.
These are the bees that before they were in a swarm, they were in the hive and they were functioning as foragers. So these were bees that were flying out across the countryside to flowers and then having to find their way back to their hive. So these bees have a lot of experience finding their way around. And now these bees have switched from searching for flowers, which of course are bright and smell wonderfully, to looking for potential home sites, which are cavities. They're dark cavities. They smell damp and dank. So they've really switched what they're searching for.
There is the idea of what makes a good home. It has to be very particular, and it has to be. We'll get in a moment to how it is that they make this decision, and how the fact is they 90-some-odd% of the time they get it pretty darn right. We'll talk about that in a moment, but what is it that what's the ideal situation? Because it's pretty particular for them.
Yes, the bees are very particular. I'll tell you what they're seeking. But let me stress at the outset, the reason they're particular is that their survival depends upon them getting good shelter.
Yeah.
Now, what is it that makes good shelter for a honeybee colony? It's actually several things, and that's why they're so picky. One thing is that they have to find a cavity that's sufficiently roomy. A colony of bees needs to get through a winter. It needs to store up about 40 pounds of honey, and they have to have enough space in their cavity to store that honey. They also need to have enough space to so that they have room in the combs, not just for honey storage, but for rearing young bees. All told, they need about 40 liters of space, which is about 10 gallons of space. And so that's a pretty roomy cavity in a hollow tree. But they also need that space, not just to be roomy, but it has to be very protective. Protective from predators and protective from the cold. So they need it to be a space that has just a small opening to the outside. It would be about just a couple of square inches would be the ideal. Furthermore, they would like this little opening to be high off the ground so that predators like bears are unlikely to detect the nest. And if they can find that entrance opening, not only high off the ground, but at the bottom of the cavity, that helps them too, because it means when they're in their cavity in the winter, the heat's not flowing out the top of the nest. So there's a lot of things. And also they like to have the entrance face south. So in the winter, when they get a nice sunny day and they can do their so-called cleansing flights, they have a nice sunny porch from which to come and to fly from.
There's a great story you tell about Martin Lindauer, who he has this revelation in 1949.
Yes.
He came upon this honeybee swarm, and he saw that several of them were performing these dances, these waggle dances. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but he was noticing that they were doing it on top of the swarm, and that they didn't have pollen, so like they had a particular job. It was his insight, I guess, was that this is their job. Their job is to go and do this thing, find the new home.
Right. He had a few clues that indicated to him, in addition to the fact that these bees were not. That we're doing these dances, and these dances share information about rich resources, important resources. He had some more clues that they were not bees coming back and advertising food sources with their dances. One of the best clues was that he noticed that some of these bees were dirty.
Yeah.
These were, in a sense, dirty dancers.
Yeah.
Some of them were even black with soot, and he told me that he plucked one of these sooty bees off, sniffed it, and he said it smelled like a chimney sweep, which indicated to him that, yes, this bee was not at all coming back from flowers. It was poking around cavities, places like broken chimneys, evidently this bee had been out looking for a new home site. And that was a breakthrough observation. Simple, but very important.
Yeah. And they were doing this dance on the backs of other bees.
That's right. In a swarm of bees, which will have about 12,000 bees in it, 95-97% of the bees are inactive. They're resting quietly, and they make the substrate. The cluster is the substrate on which the active scout bees perform their dances, which is actually wonderful for the biologist because it means the action is out on the surface
where we can
watch it.
Yeah. There's a. I wanted to ask you about the waggle dance itself. There's a story you tell in the book about another German zoology professor, Carl von Frisch. You love that guy, huh?
My hero.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Both of those gentlemen are Professor Lindauer, Martin Lindauer, and Carl von Frisch.
Yeah, Carl von Frisch. He I guess he was the first to get a sense of how a waggle dance works. I mean, he knew that they were dancing, but he figured it out in some way, I guess.
Yes. Beekeepers had known for hundreds of years that bees perform these visually striking dance behaviors, and beekeepers had wondered what it means. They had no idea. And von Frisch solved that mystery. And he did it in a very clever way. It took him about 20 years of trying. He went down some blind alleys. But bit by bit, he was a very, like Lindauer, he was a very observant and very critical thinker. And he worked out that when a bee does this dance, she's able to express in that dance information about the direction and the distance to a rich resource, and that, or attractive, desirable resource. And that could be a patch of flowers or, in the case of house hunting, a desirable home site.
So it's kind of like an equation. Like she's saying, okay, it's 40 paces to the left and then 40 paces to the right. And she's being very particular about where this could be.
Yeah, she's indicating the direction. So she would be saying in her message, she's indicating the direction relative to the sun. So she's indicating that these flower, if she's advertising, a dancing bee's advertising a patch of flowers, she's indicating the angle of the flowers relative to the direction to the sun at that moment. So she might be saying the patch of flowers that I have found is 40 degrees to the right of the sun. So if, when you go out of the hive, look to find the direction of the sun and go flying 40 degrees to the right of that direction. And then in her dance, she's also indicating how far to fly in that direction. It might be 500 feet. It might be 1,000 feet. It might be 5,000 feet. And the bee that follows the dance, we now know because we're able to track individuals that have followed dances, indeed fly out of the hive in that indicated direction, and that indicated direction once at distance. Once they've flown that distance, then they drop down and start searching for flowers, or if it's a nest site, start searching for the cavity that's been advertised. It is remarkable. I think it's fair to say, the most sophisticated form of communication among non-human animals that we know.
Hmm. So you have these about 300 to 500 nest site scouts who go out looking for the ideal spot. They'll go within a range of, I think you said, 30 square miles, something like that.
Right. Each bee can be going out for several miles. So the total area that they're covering can be 30 square miles or even more.
Yeah. They go out. They're looking for the ideal spot. Once they figure they may have found it, they come back. And then there's this debate that goes on in this bee swarm. And that's the thing I want to get to when we get back from a break. We have with us Thomas Seeley. His books include The Wisdom of the Hive, most recently Honeybee Democracy. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how honeybees make decisions. Our guest is the honeybee enthusiast, professor of the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University, Thomas Seeley. So we mentioned, okay, so the scout bees, they go out, they come back, because each one of them, I imagine, figures they found the right spot. So now, or maybe, I'm not sure if that's exactly how it works, but there's this discussion, I put that in air quotes, but they've got to have this debate about how the decision is made. Talk a little bit about that part, because now they've got to come to a decision about where they're all, as this mass, going to go.
Right. The starting point is these several hundred scout bees have fanned out across the countryside, each one searching on her own for potential home sites. Only a small fraction of those, maybe 10 or 20 of them, find something that's worthy of further consideration. And one thing I want to stress is that each individual that has found a possible home site spends about 30 minutes checking it out, measuring the key properties, the volume, the entrance size, and so forth. And by the time that 30-minute inspection is finished, she has a good sense of whether this site is superb or only so-so, or in fact is lousy. And she makes that assessment based evidently on an internal scale of quality. So at this point, she comes back to the swarm cluster and she advertises with waggle dances her discovery. And of course, as I mentioned, there's 10 or 20 scouts that have found different possible home sites. So now this group of scout bees, And it's still several hundred, but only 10 or 20 have actually found it, put an option on the table, so to speak. They have to winnow out the poorer sites and identify the best site.
Now, she has found a three.
A three.
She may not spend that much time in the waggle dance. She may not commit herself to spending too much time talking the rest into it.
That's right. That's a critical part of this decision-making process. The bees adjust how long they dance to advertise a site as a function of the goodness of that site.
Yeah.
And that biases the buildup of interest among the different sites in accordance with their goodness. And that lies at the heart of this decision-making process.
At some point, though, and I think this is, again, crucial about understanding the decision-making process, at some point she is going to concede that someone else might have a better one. This is the rest and retire part, which I think is interesting and a really critical part of decision-making.
Yes, this is something we didn't know about going in on to look at this process. We did know that if you watch the dances on the surface of a swarm, and we can build swarms where every bee is labeled for individual identification, so we can track in exquisite detail the exchange of information, the advertising, and so forth by the scout bees. When you do that, you see that some of the sites gain popularity and some sites lose popularity and, in fact, vanish from the debate, vanish from the discussion. The bees that were initially advertising those sites stop dancing for them. And a remarkable part of the process, it's brilliant on the part of natural selection by evolution, is that these bees are designed to advertise a site for only a while. Now, how long they do it depends on the goodness of the site. But every bee, sooner or later, stops advertising her site. And when you think about this, this is a very powerful way to ensure that only really good sites will continue to be part of the discussion. If a site is not good enough to attract vigorous dancing by scout bees, and thus is not good enough to attract a buildup of bees for that site, it means that the interest just dies away naturally for that site. It dies a natural death in the discussion.
There was something you discovered not so long ago. I think it was 2009, this behavior where they're headbutting and making this, I think it's a beeping noise.
Yes, this is a signal, we call it the stop signal, whereby a bee that is a scout bee that knows about one nest site. And I want to stress that each scout bee knows only about one site.
Yeah.
They're not comparing sites. These sites are widely scattered. It's a tough enough job for a bee to find one site, much less go around and compare the sites. They don't do that. So a bee knows about her site. She comes back, she does a waggle dance, which is an excitatory signal to build up interest in her site. But when she finishes doing her waggle dance, she will walk around on the surface of the swarm, and if she encounters a bee performing a waggle dance for a different site, she will produce an inhibitory signal, the stop signal, which is, as you say, is produced by the bee by coming up to the other bee while she's waggle dancing, butting her head against the body of the waggle dancer while making a little beep sound. She makes that sound with her flight muscles. And this is a little dose of inhibition. It doesn't stop the bee that's doing the waggle dancer. It doesn't stop her cold. And it's part of the logic of how these bees work together as a system, because it is a way for the bees to build a competition between different groups of bees that are advocating different sites.
Is she saying in some way to the other one, when she does this little headbutt, is she saying, just how committed are you to your site?
That's a good way to express it. She's not saying to that other bee, stop your dancing.
Yeah.
She's just saying, hold on a bit. There is another site available. It's a little bit like what humans would experience in a discussion when they've got their idea and they've promoted their idea, they've talked about their idea, but then they hear about another idea. They learn that there's another idea, and it might cause them to pause a little bit and maybe even go quiet, decide to give up on their idea.
There is a point at which you talk about they kind of come to a quorum. They decide there's a critical point where these bees dancing on the swarm all start to indicate one distance, one direction. That's the point at which there's a kind of a consensus. Is that the way to put it?
Yes. In the end of this debate, they do need a consensus. They have to have everybody agreeing that on one site, because they can only move to one site.
Right.
But the story's a little bit tricky at this point. The decision is not actually the consensus. The decision is reached when, through a process that we call quorum sensing, a site wins in this competition if it is a site that first achieves a threshold number of scout bees visiting the site.
Yeah. Stop for there, because I think that's really important. Because this point has been, they're not just blindly following. They hear that it's a good site, and they're like, okay, I'm going to go check it out.
Yes, that's right. We'll back up a step. The process starts with individual scout bees discovering particular sites. They come back to the swarm. They perform a dance to advertise their site. Some of the scouts that did not succeed in finding a site listen, observe the dance, go out, and find the site that corresponds to the dance that they followed.
Yeah.
Each of those bees that has been recruited to the site makes her own personal inspection of the site. She doesn't take the word of the bee that she followed. She evaluates it herself, and then she comes back to the swarm and does her dance according to the goodness that she judged the site to have. Now, each of these scout bees that has visited a site, checked it out, come back and danced, she then goes back to the site and hangs out at that site. She'll spend time at that site. Mm-hmm. And the reason I stress that is that's actually the vote that bee is making, that site is her favorite site. Her dance helps build up the population of bees at that site, but it's what the bees are actually paying attention to know whether a site is doing well or doing poorly, is when they go back to that site, and if they see a lot of other bees there, they know that their site is doing well. If they see that there are very few bees there, they know their site is doing poorly. And if they get to a threshold level, we think it's about 100 bees total at a site, the bees are somehow able to sense that. The bees at that site are able to sense that. They've reached what we call the quorum, and they know that our site has won. And then they come back to the swarm. They do a lot of the stop signaling. They do a lot of another signal, which actually shuts down all the waggle dancing, and it is the way the colony ultimately achieves that complete agreement.
Because is this piping?
This is the piping, because it tells a bee that's coming back from one of the other sites that, oh, decision's been made, discussion's over. I really shouldn't keep dancing.
Yeah. And then basically they're saying, too, let's get warmed up because we're going to go.
Yes, that's right. Remember, 95-97% of the bees in the swarm have been hanging there quietly for the hours or days that it's taken to make the decision. These bees have let their body temperature drop to conserve the energy that they carry. Each bee in a swarm is stuffed with honey. And the scout bees have been burning through honey, flying to and fro, back and forth between swarm cluster and nest site. But the vast majority of the bees have been hanging there quietly. And for a bee to fly, however, she has to have her body temperature, in particular the temperature of her thorax, up to close to our own body temperature, which is, for us, it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, or 97 degrees Fahrenheit. For a bee, she has to have her thorax temperature, her flight muscle temperature, up to about 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So this piping, which is yet another signal produced by the scout bees, is the signal to the quiescent, all those quiescent bees, that it's time to warm up to get ready to fly to the new home. There's a lot of steps to this process.
Yeah. Is it amazing to see?
The piping is really fun to see. It's a very conspicuous signal. And it too had been a mystery for many, many years. But we now know that it's produced by these bees that have come back from a site where they've sensed a quorum, hence come back from the winning site. They run across the backs of the quiescent bees, and periodically they stop, they press their thorax against the cool, quiet bee. They make this sound, and it tells the quiet bee that to start warming up her muscles.
Thomas Seeley is a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University. His books include The Wisdom of the Hive, most recently Honeybee Democracy. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how honeybees make decisions. Our guest is Thomas Seeley, professor of the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University. In your book, you say that one of the things you're hoping to do is give people a better understanding of how the process of honeybees could be helpful to humans to make decisions, to neuroscientists when they're studying the sort of the neural basis of decision making, because as you said earlier, there are these really intriguing similarities between honeybee swarms and primate brains. Talk a little bit about that, because I think there's this – you mentioned that, but there are these eye movement studies among monkeys, I think, is interesting, which gives us a sense of that similarity.
Yes. Neuroscientists have been looking at how our brains make decisions, and the ones we understand best are rather simple decisions, like the decision about – If we're looking at the movement of birds flying across our vision, are the birds, for example, flying to the left or to the right? Our brain has to figure that out. Yeah. Or if we're hearing sounds, if we're hearing a sound and we want to know, is that sound coming from the left or the right? Our brain has to make a decision. It's the left or it's the right. And the way that the brain does that is it runs an evidence race, which is organized really in the same way as the bees are running an evidence race when they're choosing a home. You've got different sensory units in the brain, which are like the different scout bees in a swarm, mm-hmm. coming back, providing information. So information, for example, sound, left and right. Sound is coming in from the left and the right. If the sound is coming in from the left, that the evidence of that, the sensory information is going to build up faster about information from the left than the right, just as information or popularity of scout bees builds up the fastest at the better site than at a poorer site. And in both cases, once you get a threshold accumulation of evidence, the system says, okay, that we've got enough information, we can make the decision. And then it moves forward to implement that decision. You might, if in the case if you're trying to look at an object moving to the left or right, you might move your eyes to the left or the right to track that object. In the case of the bees, the implementation is the move to the chosen site.
One of the things is to sort of how it is that we make practical use of this behavior, for example. And I wanted to ask you about, I mentioned earlier, in human societies, you know, we have come to prize the individual. I mentioned you look at movies or television programs, the hero is often the loner who sort of steps out of line, and we come to regard that with great affection, that it's the person who doesn't just stay with the group. You mentioned in your book Nietzsche, who talked about the madness of groups. Have we come to be, as human beings, naturally resistant to some of these dynamics of decision-making, group decision-making, do you think?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure we're naturally resistant to them. I would say the anthropologists who study hunter-gatherer people say that we humans have a long history of making collective decisions. When humans are in situations where their survival depends upon the individuals working together as a team, as in hunter-gatherers or in a case of a military unit, we humans are pretty good at actually working together to make decisions. the key thing is the conditions. If humans are in a difficult situation together and can recognize that their interests are aligned, then we're pretty good at it. And interestingly, when you think about some of the most important decisions we have to make are decisions which are collective decisions. Think of a jury or a board of trustees or a blue ribbon panel. I mean, these are groups that are set up to make very important decisions, and they're made collectively. But it is true that we often blow it. And when collective decision making by humans only works well when we do it when the group is well organized to do that. And that's where the lessons from the bees come in, I feel.
But it's not just a matter, we were talking a little bit off air. It's not just consensus. It's not that we're getting consensus.
Right. Good group decision making doesn't require a consensus. The bees have to build a consensus because all of the bees have to move to one home. They have to come to an agreement about everybody's going to go to this one place. They only have one queen. However, in a lot of decisions that humans make, we do have to come to a decision, but not everybody has to agree that is going to be the choice. That's why we have voting systems. To make good decisions, you don't have to have complete agreement. You just have to have the majority of the individuals or some quorum number of individuals identify the best option.
You've talked about how you have actually used bee behavior to organize committee meetings at Cornell.
Yes, that's right.
But how? What do you mean?
Well, the context is the annual faculty meeting of my department, of which I serve as chair currently and have in the past. And these are important decisions are made here. And I have shared with my faculty that I wanted to use some of the things that I've learned from the bees to make some of our most important decisions, to make them as well as we possibly can. The most important decisions are, as you might imagine, deciding who to add to that group when you're hiring a new faculty member. And so, yes, we have used those, used some of these techniques.
Swarm smarts.
I like to call them swarm smarts.
Yeah.
And these are things that I've learned from the bees, and I would like to emphasize that these things that I'll explain shortly, I learned them from the bees. But if I had been really smart, I wouldn't have had to turn to the bees. I would have looked to Quaker meeting groups or New England town meetings or hunter-gatherers. These are human groups that have, in their own way, have identified this basically the same processes.
How do they work? Give us a sense of some of them.
Well, there's five key things that I feel are critical ingredients, critical organizational features. One is that the members of the group recognize that they have a shared interest, a shared goal. They might not have the same preferences, but they all recognize they're together in solving this problem. For example, in a Vermont town. Well, yesterday was the annual town meeting in Vermont. First Tuesday in the month of March. The members of the town come together and they have these articles. And one article might be, do we want to buy a new snowplow for the town? Now, everybody's going to – in a small town, there's one snowplow. So everybody needs a snowplow, and everybody has to agree. Well, yeah, we better decide whether we want to get a new one or not. And that's similar to, it's not life and death like for the bees, of course, but it's a shared decision. So one step is the first one is a group comes together and the members of the group have to recognize, okay, yeah, I buy into this. This is an important decision for me as well as for you. A second one is that the individuals are able to bring to the debate diverse pieces of information. And this is where a group can be much more powerful than a single individual. Different people have different knowledge. Yeah. Different scout bees know about different nest sites. In that Vermont town meeting, one individual might know about the condition of the current truck. Another individual might have information about what it'll cost to repair that truck. Another individual might have information about a used truck's available in a neighboring town for such and such a price. People pool their information. And they have to be, and you have to set up the meeting or the group discussion in a way that people can feel they can freely contribute their thoughts. A third one is that people have to be able to listen to this discussion and be able to form their judgments about these ideas independently. They can hear about this person's ideas, they can hear about that person's idea, but when it comes down to actually making the vote, they have to be able to vote independently. So you don't have sort of group crowd dynamics, peer pressure, fad, that sort of thing. That's what we see in the bees. These bees come back, they advertise their site, they go to their site. Nobody's forcing them to go to this site or that site. They get to vote independently. And it's likewise in a town meeting. People can vote if it's required. They can do a secret ballot. And then you have to have a fair way of dealing with those votes. And typically we humans use a majority rule. Sometimes we have a supermajority rule, mm-hmm. whatever. The bees have done it with a quorum. Enough evidence is built up that this says this site is going to be a good site for us. So those are the critical elements of that we can see in the bees. We see it in the brain too, and we see it in that some of these human groups, they're relatively small, a town, a Quaker meeting group, a hunter-gatherer group, where you see the same elements. Interestingly, just to give you one more example to stress this, I've explained this to various beekeeper groups, and at one of them, a gentleman, a retired military individual, came up to me and said, "You know, that's what the Army teaches guys if they're in a plane and it crashes, and they're all there together, and they have to figure out how they're going to survive after that. They get together, they pool their information, they have a discussion, they deck a vote." The hierarchy of the military breaks down. It becomes a collective, distributed decision-making system. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. Thomas Ely's books include The Wisdom of the Hive, most recently Honeybee Democracy. He's in town for the Utah Symposium on Science and Literature. It is presented by the University of Utah. This year, the focus is on the way humans make decisions. Professor Seeley, thank you very much for the time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.